May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. I want to start today by looking at our Old Testament lesson. In case you haven't caught on yet, we're going through the story of David. Now, I have always said that the Bible is not exactly the greatest, the best edited, shall we say, set of stories. They don't necessarily flow in a nice linear order, and sometimes there are gaps. And the only thing that makes it harder to understand the stories is when the folks who put together the lectionary then chop the stories up into these little pieces and leave out big chunks in the middle. David is the ancestor of Christ. He is also the iconic ruler of Judaism. And I think, as your preacher, it's important to fill in some of the gaps in the story of David before we go on, because so much of what's to come only makes sense when you know what happened. You will remember a couple of weeks ago that Samuel anointed David to replace Saul. Now, Saul was one of those kings who looked really good on paper. He was tall, he was handsome, he had military experience, and he was an awful king. He was treacherous, power-hungry, sold out for political gain. He was paranoid. Sound like any politicians we know? So Samuel has anointed David, but David doesn't immediately become king. He actually goes back to tending his father's flocks. And last week, we heard about David being sent to the front lines to provide provisions, and he ends up slaying Goliath and becomes an instant celebrity. And so there David breaks out, but he's still not the king. He is now, Saul sees some talent in this young man, and certainly a lot of spirit, and makes him what we might today call a captain. He puts him over 1,000 men. And Saul and David go out, and they've been fighting the Philistines. The Philistines are the enemy du jour in 1 and 2 Samuel. They are a seafaring people that have set up shop on this little strip of land on the coast in what is present-day Gaza. Yes, the Israelites have been fighting in the Gaza Strip since 1000 BC. But here Saul and David come, and they win a great victory, and the heralds go forth, and they tell the people, Saul has killed thousands, but David has killed tens of thousands. And Saul gets jealous. Saul has the suspicion that David has been anointed to be king after him, and that here's David being heralded as this great military leader, even better than the king. But Saul has this problem that he can't exactly just banish David or get rid of him, because every street corner is talking about how great he is. So Saul sort of plays to the crowd. He is, after all, a politician. He invites David into his house. He says, come, eat and drink with me. And while David is there, he meets Saul's son, Jonathan. Now, Jonathan is the person who, in the line of succession, would be king after Saul. And so you think there might be a little rivalry there, but it turns out that David and Saul are better than best of friends. They are just so close. It is described in loving terms how David and Jonathan are closer than brothers, closer than any two have ever been. And they have this relationship of trust and of love and of mutual respect. But Saul keeps trying to have David assassinated. You know, David goes to eat dinner with Saul, and later that night someone jumps out from the corner and tries to put a knife in him. And this keeps happening, and David finally decides that if he's going to survive to see his kingship, he needs to leave town. And David becomes sort of this rebel hero, sort of this Robin Hood figure. And it turns out that he's not just a good king and a good poet, He's also a really good military commander, and he ends up saving Israel and Saul from a number of invasions by the Philistines using very small forces. He gets this reputation of being able to slip in and slip out. And Saul now at this point says, David needs to be gotten rid of. We have the whole second half of the first book of Samuel is about Saul going after David, and the story keeps going along that Saul's out looking for David in the wilderness, and David finds Saul somewhere exposed, and his men say, "Ah, you have him. Saul is in your hands. Go kill Saul and you will be king." And David says, "No, I'm not going to do that. Saul is God's anointed too, and I'm not going to do it." But he keeps doing things like stealing Saul's spear as he sleeps, and then the next morning as the armies are about to march saying, "Saul, look what I found last night." And Saul has to then say, "Well, gee, you could have killed me. I guess I better leave you alone, at least for a little bit." But this keeps happening. Finally, David ends up fleeing into Philistine-controlled lands and uses a bit of trickery, a little bit of guile to get one of the princes there to trust him a little. And his idea, he's going to follow the Philistines to war, and just at the moment that they're about to attack, he's going to kill them off in the back lines. And somebody gets wind of this idea. The generals don't trust David, even though the prince does, and they convince the prince to have David sent back home. And the Philistines in that battle end up fighting with the Israelites and killing both Saul and his son Jonathan. And the story we hear in today's Old Testament reading is about David mourning the loss of Saul, who has been his rival and been his adversary, but has also been the king of the king. And we see how much different David is than Saul, in that David understands both that Saul was an adversary, but also that he was a good man, and that he deserved to be mourned. And then we see David also mourning for this really very close friend, Jonathan, who, now Jonathan had, David had said to Jonathan, "You know, look, I've got this band of rebels, we're fighting in the wilderness, come be with me, we'll lead this rebellion together." And Jonathan says, "No, I can't desert my father. As much as I love you, I can't desert my father either." And in the end, Jonathan dies by fighting by the side of his father. And David both mourns the loss of this friend, but also celebrates his loyalty both to David and to his father. It's complicated. It's sort of this intricate relationship. It's this wonderful story that our lectionary folks have sliced up into two small pieces. The ability to honor one's rivals, the ability to mourn and yet honor the courage of somebody. If the Old Testament story is the example of complicated interpersonal relationships, then today's gospel is all the more complicated because we bring in the power of God to heal into it. Now, I think I've talked before from this pulpit about my struggle with healing miracles, the fact that they are random, that they're inconsistent, and that it bothers me to have to talk about Jesus' ability to heal in juxtaposition to those who weren't healed. And certainly, having just yesterday held a funeral for one of our dear members of this church, I struggled a lot about how to talk about Jesus' healing in light of the death of Ray Humans, in light of the death of Neva Jerkovich, Dave Jerkovich's mother, in light of a couple of very prominent deaths in the broader culture. And I found the thing that I find over and over again. It's not just about the healing. There's something deeper. There is more to these stories that is being told than merely the curing of disease. Let's look at Jairus. Jairus is a leader of the synagogue, and Jesus has been through town before. This is Jesus' second trip through town. And if you'll remember, the first time he came to Capernaum, he left before the leaders of the synagogue could really make trouble for him. He decided it was better to go preach somewhere else than to confront the leaders of the synagogue. But he's come back, he's back in town, and Jairus, his daughter, is ill. She's at the point of death. And Jairus, who is one of these leaders of the synagogue, goes out and says to Jesus, "My daughter's at the point of death. Please come help." This must not have been an easy thing. This is conflicting relationships. It doesn't tell us that Jairus left his leadership position. It doesn't say that he gave up. He had this conflicting, complicated relationship of wanting to uphold his values as a leader of the synagogue, but I also see him as this doting father. He has this 12-year-old girl that has got to be the apple of his eye, and she is at the point of death, and he is willing to try anything for her to be healed. I find it interesting that Jairus, the name in Hebrew, translates to God enlightens. And so Jesus, without asking any questions, without making any accusations, says, "Yeah, lead the way." Jesus sees in this man's eyes that this pain, that this hope goes beyond politics, beyond the social stigma that would go with asking a faith healer to heal somebody in the synagogue. It goes beyond all that to a man who needs his daughter healed. And as Jesus is walking along, we meet another character. It's a two-for-one today. The woman who had the hemorrhage for 12 years. This was a woman of means. This was not someone who would have associated usually with a peasant like Jesus. She had tried physicians and they had only made things worse. She had tried to trust in her wealth and her authority, in her ability to hire whoever, and she had not found the healing that she sought. And so, in desperation again, she had turned to hoping that maybe if she just touched the hem of this holy man's robe, maybe if she just touched the hem of Jesus' cloak, she could be made clean. Now you have to understand that her position is a bit like leprosy in that she was permanently unclean and that whoever she touched would be unclean until sunset. So by touching the hem of Jesus' cloak, she would make him unclean. And unlike something like leprosy or blindness or lameness, something that was a very public matter that everyone could see, her problem was very intimate, very personal. And so she lived sort of this very complicated relationship where she could neither be part of society nor was she completely separated from it. And when she touches the hem of Jesus' robe, she is indeed healed. And Jesus stops and takes the time to turn to her and say, "It wasn't that you touched my robe that healed you. It was that you had faith, that you trusted in something beyond yourself." He tells the same thing to Jairus. "Do not doubt, but believe." These healing stories are not about people being made better, so much as they are about people putting their trust in God. It is an interesting contrast to compare Jesus to the many physicians, those who try to heal based on their own authority, and Jesus who says, "It's your faith." It's interesting to contrast Jairus, who is so desperate that he will ask somebody who he previously had tried to run out of town, with this woman who would not even have had anything to do with Jesus, except that she had no other choice. Jesus heals these people, and he does so without flamboyance. He does, in fact, in all of Mark, Jesus is always saying, don't tell anybody. And I think that is something about Jesus' understanding that faith cannot be rooted in miracles. That's one of those faiths that grows up quickly, but when hard times come, if you don't find another miracle, the faith withers and dies. Faith stories like this are the beginning, not the end, of a faith journey. True faith is our path through the dark times. It's not a promise that nothing bad will ever befall us. It is instead a promise that God will be there in the good times and the bad. In this week, when we've experienced more than our fair share of loss, I would invite you all who have sought Christ and put your trust in him to remember that neither life nor death, nor the powers in earth nor heaven, can deny Jesus' promise of hope and new life and the power to trust in God. This trust is where we place our hope. Amen.